Okay, so last time we talked about multivariate Gaussian distributions. And we talked about the implications of the covariance matrix not being having a simple structure like an identity matrix or a diagonal matrix. And in a general case, we talked about the fact that the covariance matrix, if it was, it always has to be symmetric, of course, but if it wasn't constrained in any way, if the diagonal elements were not equal, and it had off-diagonal elements that were non-zero, the shape of the distribution, the support region would be elliptical, reflecting the fact that the shape of the distribution in 3D would have some kind of skew associated with it. Now, one of the consequences of this is that distance, if you think about the computation of distances in a space like this, the fact that the variances are not equal in both directions means one of the distances is going to tend to dominate the other. So here in this lower right, we have this elliptical support region, which means that the variance is greatest in this direction along the ellipse, which means that as you go to compute Euclidean distances between these variables, you're going to tend to find that whatever this is represented by this variable along the direction of greatest variance, that's going to tend to dominate the computations, because that variable will sort of have a range much larger than the other variable. This is a very common problem when you deal with trying to mix variables of different scales. For example, when you try to do stock market analysis and you're looking at a lot of different factors, you have some factors that may have a range from -1 to 1, and you have some factors that may have a range from thousands. If you, for example, try to use the Dow Jones Index as a measure, that's up at about 8,000, and if you try to use the interest rate as a variable, that has a range of a few percent. So how you go about mixing these kinds of variables is a well-known problem in statistics, and it involves the use of what are often called Whiting transformations. So I'm going to go through a sort of intuitive derivation of what a Whiting transformation is, and then we'll talk about the consequence of this, because this is actually a key part of what a Gaussian distribution is all about. So why is it convenient to convert an arbitrary distribution into a spherical one, as we've shown in the previous slides? Well, in a spherical space, in a space where every direction has equal variance, you can be assured that your Euclidean distance computations are much more meaningful. If you're computing the distance between two distributions, you'll get a more meaningful distance than if you're computing that in a space where one variable has a much larger variance than the other. And we're going to see this throughout the semester. So let's consider a transformation, which we'll call A sub W, which is composed of the product of two matrices, P and gamma inverse to the -1/2. Now, this phi matrix, if you're familiar with linear algebra, you kind of know where this is going to go. The phi matrix is a matrix whose columns are the orthonormal eigenvectors of sigma, the covariance matrix. And this gamma is a diagonal matrix of the eigenvalue. So this is essentially an eigenvalue, eigenvector type decomposition. We decompose the covariance matrix, which is a symmetric matrix or positive definite matrix, into a product of phi times gamma times phi transpose, where phi is a unitary matrix that represents the orthonormal eigenvectors. That just means the eigenvectors normalize so that phi has a determinant of 1. And the gammas represent the eigenvalues. Now, if you haven't seen this before, or if you're not really comfortable with this, we can talk about that offline, but it's the details of that aren't going to really be important at the moment. We just want to look at, if for some reason we decide to use this transformation, why we want to use it, you'll see in a moment, but let's just sort of pull it out of thin air and say, what if we were to use this transformation? What is the covariance of the transform variable y going to look like? So if we take the vector x and we multiply it by this transformation matrix A sub w, we will get a new variable called y. And the question is, what is the covariance structure of y compared with the covariance structure of X. The covariance structure of X is just sigma. The question is, what is the covariance structure of Y? So we can take the expectation of YY transpose, and we can write that as the product of A sub W times X times A sub W times X transpose. We can then substitute for A sub W this expression, phi times gamma to the minus 1/2. So we make that substitution in both places, and then we can apply this transform, this transposition to the second term. So we can write that, if you remember, when you have a product of matrices and you want to take the transpose, you essentially invert the order of these matrices. So we have X transpose phi, the gamma to the minus 1/2 is a diagonal matrix, so the transpose of that matrix is itself. And then we have phi transpose. So we have phi times gamma minus 1/2 to the minus 1/2 times X, X transpose, gamma to the minus 1/2 times phi transpose. So we can then note that X, X transpose, this is just the covariance of X gamma, sigma. And so now we have inside this term, we have gamma to the minus 1/2 sigma times gamma to the minus 1/2. And we can now do a few more things here. For sigma, we can substitute this phi gamma phi transpose. So we can make that substitution for sigma, and now we can essentially rearrange some of these terms by exploiting the fact that phi is a unitary matrix and that this gamma is a diagonal matrix. So we can interchange these two and write phi transpose gamma to the minus 1/2 gamma to the minus 1/2, again interchanging these, and then we have phi transpose on the end. So this gamma to the minus 1/2 times gamma to the minus 1/2, this is just an identity matrix, and phi transpose, phi is a unitary matrix, which means when you multiply it by its transpose you get an identity matrix. So all of this essentially collapses to an identity matrix. So what this says is that the covariance of Y is an identity matrix if this matrix A sub W is arranged so that you use phi times gamma to the minus 1/2. Okay, so that's what the mathematics says. Now, sort of physically, what does this imply? If we start with a random variable X which does not have a identity covariance matrix, we end up with the random variable Y, which is, so if X is Gaussian, multivariate Gaussian, but its covariance is not an identity matrix, what is the what are the statistics of Y? We apply this linear transformation to a multivariate Gaussian distribution with some covariance structure. Is Y going to be multivariate Gaussian? If you take a Gaussian random variable, you transform it by a linear transformation, what do you end up with? Okay, so that's another little thing that we need to review from our random processes, but remember, the central limit theorem says anytime you transform a random variable, it becomes more Gaussian. When you start with the Gaussian, you end up with the Gaussian. So Y here is going to be a multivariate Gaussian distribution. The only difference will be its covariance structure is an identity matrix. Now, what does that mean in terms of the support region for that distribution? If you now plotted Y, like we did for those previous distributions, what's going to happen? We started with an X which looks something like this, right? We end up with a multivariate Gaussian random variable whose covariance is an identity matrix. We end up with this. Now, why is this useful? Why is this important to us? Well, because this has the variance in every direction is equal, which means that when you compare distances, they'll essentially have the same kind of meaning because each dimension is equally important, if you will. Now we're going to we can now interpret this transformation in the context of a Gaussian distribution. If we take this this is essentially the quadratic term for the Gaussian, x minus mu transpose sigma inverse x minus mu. This is the term that's exponentiated in the Gaussian distribution. We can see now that this is essentially a weighted Euclidean distance. It's weighted by the covariance structure. And what this is essentially doing is it's trying to normalize x by its covariance. It's actually, in essence, a Whitney transformation. This distance is known as Mihalanovich distance, and it represents a statistically normalized distance calculation that results from our Whitney transformation. So this a Euclidean distance, it would be the case where the sigma is just equal to an identity matrix, and you're used to doing that. The quadratic term in a Gaussian is essentially a Whitney transformation. And that's important because it's doing a normalization based on the covariance properties of the random variable. Now we're going to see today how important it is. Now there's a link to a Java app, but we're going to come back to that a little bit later, so let's skip that for the moment. So this notion of a quadratic, this kind of a quadratic structure, we're going to see this quite a lot in pattern recognition, and that's why we spend a little bit of time trying to explain it. So let's recall our discriminant function for minimum error rate classification. We had g sub I of x was equal to the log of the likelihood p of x given omega sub I plus the log of the prior p of omega sub I. Now for a multivariate Gaussian distribution, we can go ahead and substitute for this likelihood in terms of the multivariate Gaussian distribution. We talked about that last time. If you recall the expression for a Gaussian distribution, it was 1 over two, the square root of 2 pi, you have that term, the determinant, times e to the minus, and then you essentially have this quadratic term. So when we take the log of that probability, we're left with the quadratic term minus these constants. Okay, you should be able to follow that by now. And then plus the log of the prior. So this is the discriminant function for a multivariate Gaussian distribution. And in that discriminant function, you can see this normalization by the covariance structure. We're attempting to essentially project the data into a space where all the dimensions are equally important. So let's look at this a little bit more. We can actually get a lot of insight into this by looking at some special cases. So let's first consider the case where all of the covariances for all the classes are equal, and they're equal to a constant sigma squared times I. I is an identity matrix. This is what we call the statistically independent case, equal variance, and a class-independent variance, because all the classes have the same variance, and the elements of the feature vectors are statistically independent because there's no off-diagonal non-zero correlation terms, and the variance is equal for all the classes. So this is the simplest case that we can have. All of our classes are essentially statistically the same. What we would hope in a case like this is that the only difference between the classes is reflected in the means. The classes have different means, and because of those different means, we can do some kind of pattern recognition on these classes. Now, the determinant in this case is just going to be the determinant of the covariance matrix, which we need in this computation, is just going to be the determinant of a diagonal matrix whose elements are all sigma sub squared, because this is just a constant. So we can collapse this determinant into sigma squared to the raised to the power d, or just sigma to the 2d, where d represents the dimension of the feature vector. That means that sigma sub I inverse, this normalization constant, is just going to be 1 over sigma squared times I, since this was sigma, the inverse of that simple structure is just 1 over sigma squared times I. And this also means that the sigma sub I's here, since we assumed class independence, the sigma sub I's that here are essentially independent of I, and they're just equal to a constant, which means we can essentially ignore them when we do this this discriminant function analysis. So, the discriminant function then can be reduced to, this is what we started with, and if we're going to try to maximize the discriminant function, we can essentially ignore these two terms because we've shown that this is a constant and this is a constant. So the discriminant function simplifies to this quadratic term plus the prior. But we also noted that this sigma inverse is just 1 over sigma squared, so we can further simplify this and write this just as 1 over 2 sigma squared and then we have x minus mu transpose times x minus mu. Well, a vector, this is essentially just the Euclidean distance or the magnitude of this, or the norm of this x minus mu sub I. So we can write this as the norm of x minus mu sub I squared, scaled by 2 sigma squared plus the log of p of omega sub I. Now, we can expand this a little bit further to, we can sort of multiply these terms out and write these as x transpose x minus 2 times mu sub I transpose times x plus mu sub I transpose times mu sub I, just expanding that, the multiplication of those two expressions.
I think we need a minus.
Yeah, actually, I see that there was a minus sign dropped here. Because we, actually, so, you know, a lot of times we'll alternate between signs, but yeah, there should be a minus sign here. Now, what's interesting about this computation is that if you look at the if you look at the process of maximizing or minimizing this expression with respect to I, what are the things which are a function of I? Well, we have the prior as a function of I. We have this term as a function of I. This mu sub I transpose is a function of I. But this x transpose x is not a function of I. So that means when we do this maximization, we can essentially compute this once and keep it as a constant. We don't need to let this vary as a function of I. Now, why we're worried about this is in some simple situations, we may have the number of classes could be very large in the thousands, and we'd like some way of reducing the computations associated with that. Now, this mu sub I transpose mu sub I, this is also a constant in that this is the mean of each class, and this is something that's pre-computed essentially. You do your analysis, you compute these means, you can compute those numbers, and then you can also store those numbers in memory. They don't need to be computed at the time that we actually want to do classification of the vector x. Similarly, this log of p of omega sub I is also a pre-computed constant. So the effort required to actually compute this discriminant function and to do the maximization simply involves, well, we can ignore this term because it's not a function of I. These two terms are constant, so what's the only computation that we have to do? The second term, the mu sub I transpose times x. What kind of an operation is that, mathematically? How would we describe that? If you were looking that up to do in MATLAB or on your supercomputer, what library function would you call that? That's dot product. So what's neat about this whole Gaussian modeling business is that the process of doing classification essentially amounts to doing a dot product and a little bit of scaling. And we talked last time or the time before about how many, many good algorithms ultimately boil down to some kind of dot product, and this is an example of that. These kinds of distance computations can be done very, very efficiently because they're essentially just a dot product. And that's one of the reasons why these approaches have been successful. Now, this also means that we can use essentially an equivalent linear discriminant function. We can write the expression we had previously as a product of a weight vector W sub I transpose times X plus W sub I 0, where W sub I is essentially this 1 over sigma squared mu sub I. That's a vector. And this W I 0 is a constant, which contains all of the pre-computed stuff that we need for the discriminant function computation. Now, WI0 is often called the bias or threshold for the ith category. If you take a course in neural networks, for example, you'll see this being used in neural networks, and we'll see that a little bit later. But this is also rather interesting because this is essentially a linear computation. So we can say that a classifier that uses linear discriminant functions is called a linear machine. And what's interesting about this is it really shows you how simple the pattern recognition problem is. And I cannot emphasize this enough, that pattern recognition is nothing more than finding the magical values of W. So, if you're on an exam and you're struggling for time and your professor says, think of some, or derive some pattern recognition algorithm, just pick some random values for W. That's a very valid algorithm. Doesn't require any complicated statistics. Now, it may not work very well, but the point is that this is how simple classification is. All this work we're going to do this semester boils down to finding the best values of W for your particular problem. And if for some reason you could pull those out of thin air, you know, if you're lucky, you could skip all this difficult mathematics that we're doing. In fact, you know, you laugh at that, but that's actually what, there are several classes of algorithms that effectively do that. You might remember a few years ago, genetic algorithms were a really hot idea. And they essentially did a kind of a gradient descent search for the best W's. There is actually a branch of statistical learning theory that does essentially that, that focuses on just making a guess for W and then updating that guess iteratively until you eventually converge to the best values of W. No statistics involved, no anything, just a gradient descent type approach for finding W. And those techniques can work in some cases fairly well. But it's interesting because it puts in perspective all the differences we're going to do this semester in all these algorithms and things really boils down to just a different way to compute the values of that W vector. So the decision surfaces defined by the equation. So we talked about in the two-class case, for example, we can take the difference between two discriminant functions and set that equal to zero, and that's the way we can find our decision surface. So in this case, if we go ahead now and substitute for G sub I of X and G sub J of X, we can write this X minus mu, the norm squared over 2 sigma plus the log of the prior, and we've got that in both places. Now, this has an interesting interpretation because we can put these norm terms on the left-hand side, and we can move the logs over to the right-hand side and write those as the log of the ratio of those two terms. So now we have a very interesting computation because it's essentially a Euclidean distance minus a Euclidean distance plus, and then there's some constant term here. Now let's assume for the moment that the priors are equal, which is a case you've no doubt encountered before. This log becomes zero, and essentially we have the computation boils down to computing the Euclidean distance from the ith mean, computing the Euclidean distance from the jth mean, and choosing the distance which is smaller. That's a type of classification that you probably would have done if you never entered into this course. It seems like a reasonable thing to do. If you have two distributions, you just compute the distance you are from those distributions and choose the one that's closer to you. Now, if one distribution is more probable than the other, we see now that the role that priors play, because priors are essentially going to move that boundary towards the distribution that's more probable, because you can think of it as a bias or a weighting of the distance you compute based on the fact that the one class is more probable. It'll actually move the boundary away from the more probable class, because more data will be associated with the more probable class. So the evidence that the data belongs to the least probable class has to be stronger. So the boundary actually shifts away from the distribution. Now we'll see a visualization of that in a moment. So this has a very simple geometric interpretation. This is often what's called threshold decoding. We have, in the one-dimensional case, we have our two distributions, and if the priors are equal, we essentially draw a line between those two distributions, which turns out to be for Gaussians at the point where they cross over. Now, as these priors change, as I explained, that line will move to the left or right depending on which class is more probable. If this class is more probable, the line will actually move towards the least probable class, and vice versa. In the 3D space, the author's done a nice job of providing some of these 3D visualizations, but we have here the two distributions, and the decision surface then becomes a plane which is essentially perpendicular to the line connecting the two means. So this is what's called threshold decoding, and it has a nice graphical interpretation in terms of Euclidean distances, and it also sort of underscores the importance of having the data essentially be spherically distributed. So remember, when we did this, we assumed that the covariance matrices were constant between both classes, and that they were a identity matrix, and there was a single, and the covariances of each component of the feature vector were the same. So that's essentially the case where the data is spherically distributed. So if the data is not spherically distributed, what we will often do is transform the data into a space where it's spherically distributed, so that we can use a simple threshold decoding. And that's essentially what a maximum likelihood or a maximum a posteriori decoder is. So what we've done to this point is to talk about decision surfaces for multivariate Gaussian distributions. Now let me go to the next chunk of slides and we'll continue this discussion. So what we'll do today, we'll continue this talking about this notion of threshold decoding, and then next class we'll finish this lecture up talking about error bounds. So we've been talking about this two-class dichotomizer, and we've been talking about the decision surface for developing a decision rule for that class, and we talked about how the discriminant function can be a difference of the posterior probabilities. If we do that in the log space, we can decompose this into sums of the ratios of the likelihoods and ratios of the priors. And if we're lucky enough, and this all boils down to a linear classifier, then we can call this a linear machine. And we've seen that in the case of Gaussian distributions, if that's what we've gotten. So we talked about the fact that if our data is if the support region is not spherical or circular, we can transform the data, and then once the data is transformed, we can then do a simple threshold decoding between the classes, and that essentially becomes the minimum error rate classifier. And that boundary, all we have to worry about is the location of that boundary, and the location of that boundary for the equal covariance case is just a function of the priors. And it's essentially halfway between the means, but also a function of the priors. Now, let's spend the rest of the class trying to generalize this a little bit and try to get some insight into what happens in the general case when the covariances are not equal and when the covariances are not equal and they're not simple covariances. So when the covariances are equal, when the covariances for all the classes are equal, we often call this the class-independent case. Because what that means is that the statistics of each class, the covariance statistics, are identical, and therefore we don't really need to worry about the covariances of each class. When, however, the covariances of the classes are not equal, then you're going to see that those covariances do factor into the directly into the computation, and we have to take into account those covariances. So that's what we'll essentially call the class-dependent case, because when you do what we're going to show shortly is that the only real difference between the class-independent case and the class-dependent case is when you want to compute a Euclidean distance from the mean of a class. In the class-independent case, you don't need to worry about the covariance. In the class-dependent case, you need to factor in the covariance into that computation, and we'll see that in a moment. But fortunately, the mechanics are the same. It's just a matter of whether you have to take into account the covariance. So here we're trying to decide which class X belongs to, and we're going to choose between G sub I of X and G sub J of X. And we know now that that can be written as the log of the posteriors minus the log of the determinants. That's again going back to our expression for the posteriors in terms of multivariate Gaussian distributions. These are the priors. We have the determinant. We have the determinants. We can ignore the 2 pi scale factor, and then we have two quadratic terms. It's one associated with the I class and one associated with the J class. So those are going to be written as minus 1 half x minus mu transpose times sigma inverse times x minus mu. And we have that for the I class and the J class. Now we can massage this a little bit by associating, we can sort of group things according to things that belong to x transpose, things that belong to x, and things that belong to mu. So we can take this x transpose times sigma sub j, which we're going to get from here, times x. So we've got an x transpose sigma sub j x. So if we go through, multiply all these out, and regroup these, we can write this as 1 half x transpose times sigma sub j to the inverse of sigma sub j minus the inverse of sigma sub I times x. So we have sort of a quadratic looking term here. We've got x transpose times some matrix times x. And this matrix is the difference between the inverses of the covariance matrix. And then we have something similar here. We have sigma inverse times mu sub I. Those are going to come from terms like this, times x. And we have minus sigma sub j inverse mu sub j. So we have now a term that's associated with x, but the components of that term are essentially the inverse of the covariance matrix times a vector. And then we have a constant term, which is all the stuff that has only mu's and sigmas associated with it. And then we have the priors and we have the determinants. But all of this stuff is not a function of x transpose x or not a function of x. So I've essentially grouped these things so that we have all the things associated with x transpose times X here, all the things associated with X here, and then all the things that are essentially a constant. So we can write this as X transpose times a matrix A times X, where the matrix A is going to correspond to the difference of these two inverse covariance matrices, plus B transpose X, where B is going to be this term here, the sigma inverse times mu sub I, and sigma sub I inverse times mu sub I, and sigma sub j inverse times mu sub j. And then the last term we have here is this constant term, which I'll just call C, which we can pre-compute because all these quantities are known prior to doing classification. Now, why is this function sort of interest to us? Why do we want to work it into this kind of a form? How would you describe this function to me? If you think about polynomials, it's a quadratic function. We've got essentially something here proportional to x squared, if you think about it in a polynomial sense or in a scalar sense, something proportional to x and something, and then a constant. So this means that for the two-class case, the discriminant function is essentially, at worst, a quadratic term, which is going to be some kind of parabola. Or it can simplify, in the case we saw previously, to just a line or a linear term. And the only, what really controls that is the covariance structure of the data. If the covariance structure is very simple, we end up with a line. If the covariance structure is general or complex, we end up with a curve. Okay, so do we follow that? Because now I'm going to show you some visualizations of this that sort of reflect this result. But in terms of classification between these two classes, what's nice about this is the computation is nothing more than a quadratic here times a linear term plus a constant. And all these terms, all these constants, include this matrix, this vector and such, can be computed, can be pre-computed because all these things are known to us. The covariance structure of the classes, the means of the classes, all that's known ahead of time. So classification in the general case, instead of being a linear machine, is a quadratic machine, which is still not too bad. We can work with that. Quadratic machines still have pretty good properties in terms of convergence and things like that. And we'll see that when we develop algorithms to learn the parameters of these classifiers. So let's look at the case where each class, let's sort of go back and apply this to this new form. We can go back and apply the case where we have all the classes have the same covariance, and the covariance is just a constant, sigma squared. So again, this simply means that all the classes have the same covariance, and every element of the feature vector has the same variance. That's essentially what this class is. So it's the simplest class. It's something that it's an analysis you might have done without too much thinking about the statistics, but very often I actually see the reverse, that students will apply a classifier like this, not thinking about the fact that the covariance of each class is different and such. So whenever you're doing any kind of Euclidean distance, clustering or those kinds of things, you're very often doing this, whether the classes have, you know, you're sort of ignoring the covariances of the classes. So in this case, if we go back to here, if the covariances are the same, what's going to happen to this term? Well, these two terms will just go to zero. And um, And so the matrix A is going to be zero, and we're back to a linear machine. The B term is going to simplify because this sigma inverse is just 1 over sigma squared. And this sigma inverse has the same value, 1 over sigma squared. So this is just going to be 1 over sigma squared times mu sub I minus mu j. And then for the C term, we will have the log of the ratio of the log of the priors and this these dot products reflecting the means, which are, and all of this is again, these are all constants, can be pre-computed and such. So the discriminant function simplifies to b times x plus some constant. So we can rewrite that as a vector W transpose times x minus x0, where x0 is a constant, which is given by these constant terms. And this W vector then is related to this vector B. So we can essentially we can reformulate this because the quadratic term goes away. We essentially just have some vector here times x plus some constant, and we can sort of play games with the constant to put this in the form W times x minus x0. And that's, so this is essentially just a weighted Euclidean distance calculation. And that's why in this identity covariance case, the optimal decision boundary is essentially just going to be a threshold between the two classes, or a plane, or a hyperplane in multiple dimensions. But its location is essentially going to be scaled by the priors and the values of the means and such. So what we're showing here are visualizations in one dimension. The optimal decision boundary will be a threshold between the two classes. In two dimensions, it will be a line between the two classes, and that's where the support regions come in. So here we're drawing the support regions of the two classes. The optimal decision surface will be a line between those two. And then in three dimensions, now again we're showing support regions here, but for this is essentially four-dimensional distributions. The support region is a three-dimensional distribution. The decision surface is a two-dimensional plane. So if we go to five dimensions, the support region is four dimensions, the decision surface is a three-dimensional, what we will call a hyperplane. Now we can look at a second case. We can look at the case of the covariances so previously we said the covariances were all the same, but they were equal to a constant, sigma squared. Now we can say, we can relax that a little bit and say, well, the covariances are the same, but the covariance matrix itself may not be diagonal. So that produces, remember, a rotation of the support region. So this is what we call equal covariances, because all the classes still have the same covariance, but the covariance is not simply a diagonal matrix. So in this case, the location of the threshold changes a little bit based on the statistics of the covariance matrix, and then we still have the means and the priors. So this is just going back to this equation and assuming that sigma sub j is equal to sigma sub I, which is just equal to sigma. And then we can do a little bit of simplification on that. The boundary, we still get this nice property that the boundary is essentially a threshold in one dimension, a plane in two dimensions, but what changes is the plane itself is rotated based on the covariance, because the support regions are rotated. And again, an easy way to visualize this, or an easy way to sort of make this simpler, is to take the data, in this case, and transform it using a whitening transformation. Then we can go back to the simple thresholds and decision surfaces that are vertical. But when the covariance is not an identity matrix, all that really happens is, instead of this plane being vertical, in this case it's rotated depending on the covariance structure. So we have some visualizations of that here. In this case we have the two-dimensional case. The support regions are two dimensions. The decision surface is a line between them, but that line is going to be rotated depending on the covariance structure of the data. It's still going to connect. It's still going to be a line which you can find the coordinates of this line by taking the means, drawing a line between the means, and then drawing a line perpendicular to that. But the actual equation of that line is going to change depending on the covariance. And we have an applet that will let you play with this, and we'll do a little bit of that next class. And then the priors, of course, are still going to move that line close or away from a class, depending on which class is more probable and which class is less probable. Okay, have I exceeded your visualization limits yet? Because the next slide probably will. So are you with me here, sort of? Threshold decoding actually historically was done in the 60s with digital communications. Some of the first digital communication systems actually used threshold decoding. And a lot of this was developed, but it wasn't kind of generalized to a lot of different kinds of pattern recognition problems and things. But the concept of being able to compute some kind of linear or quadratic function and then simply do a threshold check, that was very important in the 60s because they had very limited digital hardware capabilities. So this was exciting because you could do all this with exclusive ORs and all very, very simple kinds of electrical circuits. And even today, when you're talking about of communications equipment that's running in the gigahertz ranges, these kinds of computational considerations become really important because every cycle is important when you're dealing with digital communications equipment that's running at many gigahertz and operating on data in the 5-10 gigahertz range. Okay, so here's the money slide. This is arbitrary covariances, and this gets really interesting. And again, we have an applet that will lets you play with this in two dimensions. What I really liked in the textbook were these three-dimensional visualizations. So here we have the data. Remember the data. The data. What is the dimensionality of the data in this case? These are the posterior functions, and those are 3D, right? Which means the data is 2D. So data is 2D. The support regions are the projections when you cut those distributions with a plane, and then the lines represent the decision surfaces between these classes. And depending on the structure of the covariance, you can actually get some really interesting decision surfaces, particularly if the data overlaps, if the means of the two classes are the same but they have different covariances and things like that. So you can get some pretty complex decision surfaces. Now in this case we have data which is 3D, posteriors which are 4D, support regions which are 3D, and decision surfaces which are sort of two-dimensional, except you can see that in some cases you can actually get very complicated decision surfaces because the covariance is essentially warping that line, you know, what might have been a line for the simple case, it's kind of warping it into a quadratic function. So in the 3D case, what happens is instead of getting a plane, you can get like a cylinder, or you can get these very complicated kind of curving hyperplanes or whatever you call those things. But ultimately, it all is really just threshold decoding. It's just for a test vector computing a weighted distance between those two classes and choosing the class which has the smaller distance. But those distances are weighted by the covariances of the data. So we'll stop here. That worked out. And then next class, I'll show you this little Java app that we have, and we'll do some games, we'll look at some distributions and some decision surfaces and such. And then we'll talk about some theoretical things about air bounds, how we can do some bounds on the airs and why air bounds might be of interest to us. Okay, I will see you on Monday.